Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. On this edition of Michigan Writers on the Air, I'll be chatting with veteran journalist Jeff Smith about his extended profile of a close childhood friend. The book is titled Becoming Amish. Then, imagine house hunting in rural northern Michigan and the realtor showing you a property with a scaled-down version of Dodge City, Kansas, circa 1870, in the front yard. Natalie Ruth Joynton will read from and talk about her memoir, Welcome to Replica Dodge. At the end, Fleeta Brown will read from Michigan poet Chris Dombrowski's newest book. I'd like to welcome Jeff Smith to Michigan Writers on the Air. Jeff was the longtime editor of Travers, Northern Michigan's magazine, and now serves as the communication director of Groundwork, a nonprofit organization. Welcome, Jeff.
Hello. Thank you.
Today we're going to be talking about your book, Becoming Amish, A Family's Search for Faith, Community, and Purpose. Jeff, could you share with our listeners how you got started on this project and your relationship with the two main people in your book, Bill and Tricia Moser?
Sure. Well, a really important thing is Bill Moser and I have known each other since we were both 4 years old, growing up in a neighborhood of Livonia, just a couple doors apart. And we stayed friends throughout life. You know, we went to elementary school, middle school, high school, did, you know, standard mischievous sorts of things along the way. And also met Tricia, his wife, about time he did, in 10th grade, actually. So it goes back quite a ways. And Bill and Tricia were just kind of everyday Livonia kids like I was and all our friends. And when they got married, I was best man in their wedding. And when my wife and I got married, he was best man in my wedding and all that good stuff. And so life moved on and we stayed close. But then my wife and I moved to Minneapolis. Just that distance, we kind of grew apart a little bit from the Mosers. That apartness was also exacerbated a little bit because they became increasingly religious and my wife and I really did not. And so about 13 years later, we moved back to Michigan, and Tricia, I don't really know how she knew we were back in Michigan, but she called me at work one day and said, Jeff, why don't you come and visit us? And I won't tell Bill you're coming. It'll be a surprise. And I said, oh, okay. That sounds like fun. And I happened to be going downstate actually like later that week or something. And they were living just north of Lansing and St. John's countryside kind of. And I pulled into their driveway and there was a buggy, not with a horse attached, but clearly an Amish buggy and a horse out in the field. And I had no idea that's what I was going to see. And I just kind of sat there and let that sort of spin around in my head for a while, and then went and knocked on their door. And sure enough, they appeared at the door dressed as Amish people dress. And that's when this story kind of began. And so a bit later then, that was maybe 97, 98, something like that. And then about a decade later with the crash, the economic crash, we were having editorial planning at the magazine. And I said, you know, you might think this story is really weird and kind of boring, but what if we wrote a piece looking at a family that truly has made the decision to pursue a simple life, which I don't know if you or your listeners recall back in 08 with the crash, everyone was talking about, has America learned its lesson with credit? Has America learned that materialism isn't everything? Will this be, you know, a new way of living now that people kind of, in a way, didn't have a lot of choice in many cases? And so I said, why don't we look at a family that made this choice and found a real richness in making that choice? And everyone really liked that idea. So I wrote a magazine story for Traverse, Northern Michigan's magazine, about that. And that's how the narrative then began.
And in the book, you follow this transition from sort of a young suburban couple or urban couple mm-hmm. to this very different life. Mm-hmm. And this is not an easy transition. This mm-hmm. is not just joining a church. There are mm-hmm. a lot of challenges along the way. Mm-hmm. Language, mm-hmm. a completely different lifestyle, learning to make a living in this kind of community. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah, it is a very difficult transition. There is a researcher who has studied the Amish a great deal. He's really America's leading Amish cultural researcher. And he actually has said that there are only 75 people he could find from like the late 50s or something like that who have actually joined the Amish church and stayed a part of the faith. That is a very, very small number. And that gives you a sense for how difficult that transition is. The language you mentioned, yes. So the Amish, most of them would be bilingual. But when you immerse into another culture, if that language is sort of there all the time, even if they switch to language when you're in the room, it's just a ever-present thing that you are separate from that culture, and
that language is?
They would call it Pennsylvania Germans. A lot of times people refer to it as Pennsylvania Dutch, but it's actually German. It's Pennsylvania German, yeah. And so that was just a really big thing. They worked really hard to get it, but they couldn't, and there aren't, or at least there weren't at the time they were making the transition, any really decent learning tools. There's not tape or even books, really. I've heard that now there are. But so that was a really big thing. And the Moseses are very quick to say that their communities did work hard to help them assimilate. And they not to give away the end of the book, eventually they also left the Amish culture. But they gave it 10 years, and their community helped them get a business started, help them build their home, help them. They would, back to the language idea, they would have a translator sit behind, say, Bill, and another sit behind Tricia throughout a 3-hour church service, live translating every single thing that was said, during the service. So a big commitment on the part of that community, but it just kind of shows how difficult that all is, yeah.
So the communities consist of about 30 families.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there are differences within the family.
Yeah.
And there are people who separate, form new congregations or groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting part of the Amish culture that I was not aware of. We think of the Amish because they hold to old ways and they dress in older style, and they just give off this sense that they are sort of fixed in place and time, for that matter. But there's actually quite a bit of change in the Amish culture, and so, as you just alluded, some of it is structural to the faith. When there are 30 families and then they grow kind of beyond that size, there's a very intentional decision, okay, who's going to split off and create a new church, because we don't want our churches more than 30 people. So that's very intentional and kind of baked into the process. And then, of course, there are differences over how the faith is interpreted, and with especially all those rules around technology and how to behave, there are differences in the boundaries of those things. Like, do we allow a cell phone? Do we allow a phone in a person's shop because they just kind of need that to make a living? Or do we say, no, there is one phone in our entire community, and it's in that phone booth over there on the hill? So people split off based on differences over technology, as well as splitting off just because the church gets to a certain size and they just all agree this is how we do it, and they make a new church. So, yeah. And of course, there are just personality differences all along the way, just as we have in general society. And that was one thing I really want to make sure came through in the book, is that You know, I feel like so much of the way Amish are portrayed, it's either, oh, aren't they kind of sweet, simple people? Or maybe they're made fun of because they're simple or something. But either way, there's kind of a lot of caricature out there about Amish. And I really wanted to make sure that we portrayed Amish people as real humans and as complex and diverse as we all are, you know. And I think we achieved that.
So let's take a minute and talk about technology. Mm-hmm. What technologies are allowed, what aren't allowed, and mm-hmm. how does that change? Because I was sort of surprised in your book mm-hmm. by the fact that he could actually set up a factory of sorts mm-hmm. with a yeah. lot of technology.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right. I mean, it fully was a factory. So this is another one of the big surprises to me, and I think when I talk about the book, surprise to many, is there is a real range of technology that is accepted throughout the Amish world, you might call it. And each of these 30 family church groups can decide on the technological boundaries that are allowed within their community. And so there is a big range of communities out there and associated rules. And so in one community, you might not be allowed to mow your lawn, or you might not be allowed to grade the road in front of your house, and you have to use steel wheels on your buggy. In another community at the opposite end, you might be able to have a diesel-powered tractor to do your farming with, and you might be able to drive that tractor to church with your family in a trailer in the back, which is starting to be a lot like a car, you know. Other communities, the phone's a big thing. So like I alluded to earlier, you might be allowed to have a cell phone, or you might be only allowed to have a landline in your shop so you can do business, but no one's allowed in that community to have a phone in their house. And so the, as I say, each community can make a choice. A big decider for what technology is allowed or not allowed, so much of it gets back to a community's interpretation as to how that will affect the cohesion of the family and the cohesion of the community. And so, for example, one of the conversations that Bill and Tricia had in their community was, would homes be allowed to have propane lights in every single room, or would the propane light only be allowed in, say, the living room or kitchen, common areas, so that at night when it got dark, people would have to gather together in the living room to read, as opposed to going off into their individual bedrooms and reading. And I found that to be really interesting, because there's a corollary in my own community where somebody we knew traced the breakup of their family to when a husband brought home a television for every single kid, and suddenly they were all watching television in their own rooms instead of huddled on the couch watching together. And of course, that was a while back, so now of course that would be the computer and the phone and everyone separating to just troll the internet or whatever. Another interesting technology thing they dealt with was somebody in their community wanted to get a hay baler that could be run by one person. And the big conversation was, well, that means that people would not have to gather together and help one another to harvest hay, and that would erode the bonds of community. And I can't remember if this man had maybe some kind of disability or something he was dealing with, but the decision was they allowed him to have that piece of equipment, but nobody else used it. So he was allowed to use it, basically. But the others kept gathering together and doing things like big farm chores like that. So I find that to be really one of the most amazing things for us all to think about, is how is technology pulling us apart, or maybe kind of allowing us to drift apart. And it's a great reminder to be intentional about our gathering and, you know, staying together with friends and doing things that might seem less efficient, but in the long run are better really better for us all. Yeah.
So that sort of leads to my next question. You talk in your book about child rearing and education. The children in Amish communities are numerous. And the family is sort of central. The family and the community are central to Amish life.
Yes. And that is something that they never, ever, ever forget, like with every breath they take every single day, is they are living to support their family, to support their brothers and sisters in their community, and of course, to connect around their faith. And, you know, for me, again, that was such a reminder about how they have hung on to just a very enduring sense of humanity. And again, back to the technology thing, I feel that our technology kind of allows us to drift apart, be alone, be individual. And the Amish, you know, because of their everlasting focus on community and togetherness, just keep that forefront all the time. And I just think it's something for us all to really, really remember as we move through life.
I'm talking with Jeff Smith, and we're talking about his book, Becoming Amish. Children go to Amish schools, and formal education ends at the eighth grade. And yet I imagine kids continue to learn and acquire new skills. How does that all happen?
Yeah, I think that's another super interesting part. You know, if someone said to you, oh, my son dropped out of school in eighth grade, you would think that person has no chance in our society or very little chance. Or maybe you even think, oh, he's chosen a life of ignorance, and that's not a good thing either, of course. But that is not really how it plays out in the Amish culture. And this is very much gotten to in the Supreme Court case in which the Amish were allowed to pull their children out of school in eighth grade. And the line of reasoning that the lawyers took who were helping the Amish was to say, let's look at these people as a whole. And they put, like, say, the sheriff on the stand and said, are you having to arrest a lot of Amish people? And of course, the answer is no. And they put, say, a local social worker on the stand and said, are you having to spend a lot of your funds on welfare for Amish people? And of course, the answer was no. And the school principal, are the, you know, kids causing trouble or whatever? No. And so the point is, it's another paradox, really. It's like these people are educated to eighth grade, but they go on to lead in, you know, many very high percentage of cases, successful lives by all the important things that we measure. You know, they will have successful families, and they will have work. They will not cause trouble. They don't actually even take government welfare, you know, in almost all cases. They don't even accept social security payments that they're due in many cases because of their faith. So obviously, though, the big difference there is they have an entire culture built around supporting people who leave their schooling in eighth grade. But one, just again, back using the Mosers as an example, a really interesting case. Trisha's brother is actually the chief financial officer of one of Michigan's bigger universities. And he was visiting them and looking, you know, talking about their businesses that they have. And one of their businesses is a trust building shop that one of their sons runs. And their son, I think he was homeschooled. I'm not even sure he went to Amish school. And so because this gentleman's a CFO, he says, I want to look at the books, which of course, you know, most of us would never want to go there. But he was curious, like, can this boy really be running this trust business, you know? And he went in there and looked at the books, and he was just astonished at how immaculate these books were kept.
You talk about religious persecution, and there's a long history of that, not only in this country, but in Europe, where this religion first started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if a lot of people are fully aware of that. I was absolutely not aware. Back in about the 1500s, it was actually the Mennonites mostly and other Anabaptist faiths were persecuted by the powers in, say, Switzerland and Germany, where the government and the religion were one, basically. And so these were Catholics and Protestants, and they did not want the Anabaptists pursuing their faith. And I'm sorry, the Anabaptist is a broader term that kind of encompasses Mennonites and Amish and some others who share a statement of faith. And so they're very similar in their beliefs. And one of those core beliefs is that in order to be a true Christian, you need to make an intentional decision in adulthood that you are a Christian and you've accepted Jesus as your Savior. And so that meant they did not believe that an infant could make that decision. And so that baptism at birth that is so common really didn't mean anything. They rejected that. And that divide then caused the powers to be to persecute the Amish, or actually it was the Anabaptists, because the Amish actually didn't come till a little bit later, but you know, they're precursors. And it was terrible. They killed thousands of people, like burning them at the stake and drowning them and, you know, doing all these things. And so that persecution, which kind of started to dial down toward the end of the 1600s, when the Amish actually split away from the Mennonites and reformed. But either way, that history of persecution has stayed with them. It's kept very much alive in a big fat book that most Amish homes would have, called The Martyr's Mirror, that chronicles. It was actually written in the 1600s, and it chronicles all the people who were killed that way, based on court records and whatnot. But that persecution, the story of that persecution, and because these people are intentional about staying tied to their history, those stories are very much alive with that faith, and it in part informs, you know, their enduring belief in separation of church and state, because they, of course, predecessors saw firsthand what that really meant when, if you change faith or principles of your faith, it was viewed as heresy and carried a death sentence.
I'm talking with Jeff Smith, and we're talking about his book, Becoming Amish. The Mosers children, mm-hmm. have they remained in the faith, or have they moved to a Mennonite or...
So the Mosers, after 10 years as Old Order Amish, did actually transition to a very closely aligned faith called Amish Mennonite, and their children all followed them into that. Again, the statement of faith that they adhere to is the same. The technology rules are different, so they can drive a car now, and that's kind of the big... Oh, they can have electricity in their homes. So the big thing that's different between, say, their community and general society is no real access to the internet, no television, so kind of cut off from mass media, basically. But all the children have remained in the faith and seem to be very, very happy in the faith. And that was something I didn't really know heading into it. I kind of thought that the kids would have rebelled against being, you know, kind of hauled into this restrictive environment. You know, the oldest son was 11 or 12 when they made the change. Big time of transition and social awareness. And but what I found was the complete opposite. They loved joining the Amish faith, and they loved it because they had so many friends. You know, they had all these big families, and for the boys, all these boys to roam the fields with and go hunting and ride bikes and horses, and their daughter having all of her friends as well, and just the really warm embrace and support of that community. And it just meant so, so much to them, and still means so much to them, and made them all really, really happy, which, you know, again, heading into it and coming from general society, I was thinking, oh my gosh, these kids must think, what have my parents done to me? They brought me into this really odd environment. What am I supposed to do? And I just found it was completely the opposite. And I think I think a lot of it gets back to that sense of security that people need to evolve to their full selves and feel really good and optimistic and strong about their future. And I think those kids have that.
And you referenced that, the difference between the central culture that very much supports the concept of individuality
mm-hmm.
and their culture, which is all about cooperation and family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Oh, that I think is another really big one. And in talking with one of the Amish bishops, he referred to it as America's cult of individuality or the altar of individualism. He said that is actually the biggest challenge people face in transitioning to Amish. And he had a really interesting observation that he felt that the very same trait that allowed people to break away from general American society and join Amish, that is a certain sense of like being a renegade or going against the grain, of course became the same thing that made it difficult to remain Amish because you have to conform even more. But Bill Moser definitely viewed joining the Amish as an act of, defiance is maybe not the right word, but, you know, something, an act against society and leaving things that he did not really agree with. And one kind of funny thing. My son was working in Manhattan and he was carrying a copy of my book, title out. So it says Becoming Amish. He was kind of walking into a building and sort of as he was going in, another guy was coming in the same door and they sort of, you know, were right there with each other. And it was this big sort of biker guy, you know, classic Harley looking, whatever, Hell's Angels sort of looking dude. And the guy looks down and he sees the title of the book and he looks at my son and he goes, "All right, going against the grain." And I just thought that was so funny that that man instantly connected with that idea and saw that just in that instant that was, you know, an act of defiance at some level and adopting this entirely different lifestyle. And that is a very big thing. I think I personally agree that the idea of individualism in America right now has been taken to extremes, and it has become almost like a caricature of itself. And I think while I'm not arguing for people to step away from their own sense of individualism, and I think individuality can certainly live in a community, I think what the Amish can remind us is, maybe not leave behind that, but that can live side by side and with a stronger sense of community. And we need to be reminded of that. Again, kind of back to that Wendell Berry quote of, we're not whole till we're also a part. And, in the Amish culture, the idea of pride is not a good thing. Like, that's prideful, that you're not supposed to go there. You're not supposed to celebrate and cultivate your own sense of individualism. So it is a very, very different culture in that respect.
Jeff Smith, this is a fascinating read, Becoming Amish. It held me from beginning to end. It's one of those books you drop into a chair and finish.
It's a compelling story. Their story, you know, that took a lot of courage, and it was a real honor to share that. I really wanted it to be accurate, as you can imagine, since I'm a journalist, but also just to honor them as a family and their community. And something happened not too long ago where the director of an Amish Mennonite center in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which kind of, you know, as everybody knows, is a huge homeland for Amish. He was asked to name 5 books that really represent what it's like to live and be Amish. And he named Becoming Amish as one of those picks. And there's, you know, thousands of books out there about the Amish. So I don't know. I almost started crying when he said that. I was so happy about that. But I feel it's true to their story. And I guess that's what meant the most to me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's a collection of stories over so many years. And mm-hmm. they're compelling stories. Mm-hmm. So thank you. Yeah. Where can readers find this book?
Horizon, downtown Traverse City, always has it in stock. Really, locally, that's about the only place I know of for sure. Others might buy it through Ingram, and I'm not aware of who purchases through Ingram, so I just don't know. You could call your bookstore. I encourage people to do that.
If you wander into any bookstore, they will order it.
They'll order it, yep. And of course, it's available on Amazon, and there's a Kindle edition as well. Or you can order off my website at becomingamish.net.
Jeff Smith, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm delighted to welcome Natalie Ruth Joynton to Michigan Writers on the Air. Welcome, Natalie.
Thank you.
Today we're going to be talking about your new memoir from Wayne State University Press, Welcome to Replica Dodge.
Yes.
And Natalie, when we say Dodge, we're not talking about the automobile. It's sort of a Wizard of Oz moment, isn't it? We're in Kansas.
Yes, somewhat. We're in Kansas and we're in Michigan, and I'm thinking about Houston. All of that comes into play in this memoir. So Replica Dodge is the name of the property that I moved to in rural northern Michigan. It's in Mason County, and it's 4 acres in what most people would call the middle of nowhere. And the really interesting thing about this piece of property that we moved to is that the previous owner was just obsessed with gun smoke. And he built a replica of Dodge City, Kansas, in our front yard. So it's 10 buildings in total. And there's a saloon, there's a bunkhouse, there's a ladies' emporium. And I kind of went to this property for the first time, and I thought, wow, this property, this Dodge City, is about as out of place as I am here in rural northern Michigan. So, yeah.
And the realtor sort of poo-pooed the idea of Replica Dodge. She wanted you to look at the house.
Yes. So as soon as we got there, you know, we had looked for at a number of properties in and around Mason County. And honestly, nicer houses than the one that we own now. But yeah, we arrived here to that property and I just thought, wow, that's so odd. And of course, I went immediately and wanted to explore the spectacle of Replica Dodge on this beautiful 4 acres that in the rolling hills.
And skip the house.
Yeah. But the real estate agent, her name is Pam, she was like, oh, just don't worry about that. You can tear all that down and come on inside the house. And I thought, no, this is, somebody took their time with this. Somebody worked really hard trying to create this.
So you grew up in urban, suburban America. You grew up in Houston. Your world was filled with museums and concerts and all those city things.
Opera in the Heights and tuba recitals at Rice University and academic lectures and all of the beautiful and wonderful things that cities have to offer.
And lots of kids at that time get piano lessons or violin lessons.
Or flute lessons, or something like that.
And you ask your parents for what?
I asked my parents for writing lessons. And they were, you know, the wonderful thing about my parents is that they fully supported it. In fact, my dad was a philosophy professor at a local community college, and he actually hired another English professor to come work with me each Wednesday afternoon to take my writing seriously from a very early age. They knew that it was a passion of mine and they ran with it. And I'm so thankful.
And then there was this transition to Michigan.
Yes.
Your father took a job in Michigan.
Yes.
Alpena Community College.
Yes. Yeah. So he sort of worked his way up in Houston. And then when I was in my freshman year at the University of Houston, I was really surprised one day. I had come home, you know, I was home for the weekend and doing the regular things that college kids do, visiting their parents and doing laundry and all of that. And my dad just sort of announced that he had taken this job in Alpena, Michigan.
Oh, by the way, Alpena, Michigan.
Alpena, Michigan. And it was a place that I had never heard of. And I remember, you know, my sister Lauren, who's a little bit older than me, I remember asking her, where is Alpena, Michigan? And she looked at me and she said, nowhere. So it was just this, I didn't really ever think about Michigan before my parents landed here when I was about 18 years old.
So there was another big change in your life about that time that was just in process, and that was finding your religious roots, or maybe escaping your religious roots and finding another tradition. You grew up in a Southern Baptist family, your grandparents, your parents were Methodists.
Right.
And you started on a different course.
Yes. So much of this memoir is about a sense of belonging. And belonging can be such a powerful force of good in a person's life, belonging to somewhere or something or someone. But if you don't have that, and I didn't have that with Christianity, you can feel fairly adrift. And so I realized that at an early age, I had a deep love and affection for both Christianity and the Christians who had raised me, but I just did not feel spiritually at home there. And so when I was about 18, I happened to take a course at the University of Houston on world religions, and then from there took a course on Judaism taught by a rabbi, and very quickly realized that it was much more in line with my belief system.
So Judaism is not a proselytizing religion.
Correct.
You can't just join.
Yes.
So it is a long process, a long time.
Absolutely. You know, I like to say that with the right mind and the right kind of heart, I suppose, you can become a Christian within a matter of seconds, but it takes a long time to become Jewish. It takes many years. You have to have sponsorship from a rabbi, and you've got to study very hard and read and know enough Hebrew and all of that to become Jewish. So it's quite a trek.
And you touch on this topic, becoming Jewish, across the whole memoir.
Yes. It's kind of interwoven with this stranger in a strange land narrative that's happening. So I'm not only coming to rural northern Michigan as an outsider, but I'm also taking stock of that huge transformation in my life that took many years to get to. You know, it took me many years to become Jewish, to be recognized as a Jew among Jews, and then I landed myself very promptly where there were no Jews.
Another part of that process was meeting the man who you were going to later marry.
Yes.
And finding out about romance in Upper Lower Michigan. It's not like Houston, is it?
No. So the man that I eventually married, my husband, his name is Joe, and he was born and raised in and around Alpena, where my parents landed. He was raised on some acreage full of cedar trees and, you know, horses and stray cats and all of that, you know, wonderful northern Michigan kind of feel. And then I met him, and he was so different than anybody I had ever met. You know, the kinds of dates that I was going on in Houston with guys from the city were very much in line with the kind of things that I had done growing up, like, you know, patio dining and tango lessons and poetry readings and all of that. And then here comes Joe, and he's a little rough around the edges, but he's gorgeous, and he's very smart, and he's become a physics professor since then. But when I met him, he was just a really good student and bright and like nobody else I had ever met. And the first thing he did was invite me to go midnight sledding, which is something so out of this world, you know, after having come from Houston. And he asked me to meet him at a place called Kramer's Truck Stop in the middle of winter in the dark. And I did it because I just was intrigued by this person. And I remember standing there in the freezing dark thinking, am I crazy? I don't know this person. And yet we went sledding that first night. And it was this sublime and magical experience, and it was like nothing I'd ever experienced before.
And how was this sledding slope lit?
So what we did was we kind of angled the car so that the lights from the car would illuminate the snow, the slope down, and that's how we saw our way down.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. The process of writing Replica Dodge, this is 5 years. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. So it's a reasonably short book. You know, I think somewhere, you know, just over 200 pages, and it took me 5 years to write. And that's typical of first time authors. That first book is like this giant leap, right? And you're just trying to figure out the process of it. You probably know how this goes, right? But I was also doing some other things. You know, I got married. I was pregnant very shortly afterwards. And then my daughter was born, and I didn't write for an entire year. Because like most mothers I know, I was just trying to make sense of my life as a parent and all of its demands. And for every mother I know, there is the before you had children and there's the after. So I was just trying to take stock of where I was at. And then I got back to the writing.
When you write memoir, lots of us are used to this genre with a lot of nitty-gritty kinds of things, addiction, abuse, trauma. There's none of this in your book, but you deal with very sensitive issues, questions of faith, relationships, whether or not you're at home in this new community, how you're going to find a faith community. Could you talk about how you worked through that as you wrote this book? And how you developed trust with people, because these are very sensitive topics.
Right. So I like to say that a lot of creative nonfiction, this genre.
And can you define that a little bit, creative nonfiction?
Sure. So creative nonfiction is a genre that kind of pulls upon the author's own experiences in life, but steals a lot of the kind of writing moves that fiction writers make. So they really, they make their own experiences almost into like a novel-like experience, right, for the reader. But everything is factual. Everything in there actually happened to the author. So that's kind of how I define it. But yeah, I mean, that's the hard thing about creative nonfiction is you've got to tell the truth. And as my editor, Annie Martin, would say at Wayne State University Press, if you're not telling the story, what are you doing? And so you can't conveniently turn away from all of the up in the air aspects of your life. You've got to sit down and you've got to switch a floodlight on them. And you've got to watch the way that they move in the air above your head, because you don't know, you know, so much of this memoir was me trying to navigate my next move with these parts of my life that were up in the air. And so it's really uncomfortable work. But it's immeasurably more disconcerting when you share a life with somebody. You know, I share my life with my husband, Joe, and I share a great deal with my friend, Jen, and both of them are major characters in the book, and they're unknowns, and the parts of their life that are a little bit up in the air are here too. So you've got to be forthright, and you've got to be fair, but you've also got to be loving, because these are the people that you love. And kind and respectful, and that's the beast of it, right? Like, that's the tightrope territory.
Did you allow them to read the manuscript?
Yes. So I did give them some very early copies of the memoir before I sent it out for publication. So before I was even seeking publication, they read it. But I will never forget when my editor, Annie, called me, and it was very shortly after she offered me a contract, and she said, "Natalie, you know, you keep alluding to all of the inherent difficulties of being in an interfaith marriage, but you're not really showing me that yet on the page." And I thought, oh no, she's right. And I remember putting the phone down and going to my husband and saying, you know, I've got to explore this fully in this memoir. And I didn't realize it at the time. He's a fairly quiet guy, and he really didn't say anything about it after that. But he didn't read the memoir again until it was a thing in the world. So that's 2 years. Mm-hmm. And he knew he was going to be playing this major role in the book, and yet he didn't read it. And I kept on trying to make sense of that. I thought, why is he not reading it, you know, at all of its stages? But then I quickly realized afterwards that he didn't want to be in the position to ask me to take anything out. And that in and of itself was, for a man who doesn't believe in God, who's a physics professor, who's very science oriented, that was a huge leap of faith. And everything is, right? When you get right up to it,
yeah.
We take these leaps of faith and we trust in one another and we try to build homes in spaces where we don't belong.
Could I get you to read from the book?
Sure. So I'm going to read from the part of my memoir that we talked about a little bit earlier about going midnight sledding with the man who eventually became my husband, Joe. And we meet at a truck stop, which... you know, all of my city girl insides were like, what is this person? What is he asking me to do, meeting him at a truck stop in the middle of nowhere? But here we go. Kramer's truck stop was closed when I arrived, and I stood in the freezing dark. I began to consider how little I knew about Joe, this person I was meeting alone. I looked ridiculous in the giant yellow snowsuit I had pulled over my clothes. But then Joe was there, pulling up in a beat-up Buick Regal. He leaned over and swung the door open. In the glow of the car's overhead light, he grinned. Hey! His teeth were crooked and jammed together, but he was striking. We drove to a hill far outside of town. We parked and Joe turned the car lights on to illuminate the high-sloped snow. Then we hiked up. At the top of Manning Hill, Joe showed me how to give a running start before jumping on the sled, and I managed to tuck myself in just before it careened downward. When I think about that night now, I remember the speed of the sled. It was incredibly fast. It felt dangerous whipping in and out of the car's lights, with the dark trees on either side of us. I remember the fresh snow churning up in my face as we hurtled downhill. It was freezing, but after hiking up the hill a second time, I started to sweat under my snowsuit. I wriggled out of it, getting down to my jeans and sweater, as Joe retrieved a second sled. I remember we didn't talk much, but when we did, I was at the top of the hill, and Joe was at the bottom, and we were hollering over the wind and trees in this empty, sublime place that swallowed one's voice and returned nothing but more dark and cold.
Oh, lovely. Thank you so much. Natalie Ruth Joynton reading from Welcome to Replica Dodge. If listeners want more information about you and your work, you have a website?
Yes. So the easiest way to access my website is just to Google Natalie Ruth author, and that will come up with my Facebook page, and you can access my website off of my Facebook page. But you can also buy the book online. You can buy it through IndieBound, but it's also available right here in Traverse City at the Horizon Bookstore.
Natalie Ruth, thank you so much for being here. It's a wonderful read.
Thank you so much for having me, Aaron. Thank you.
Fleta Brown is here. Welcome, Fleta.
Hi, Aaron.
And today you'll be talking about Michigan poet Chris Dombrowski.
I am very excited to talk about Chris Dombrowski's new book. It's called Ragged Anthem. Chris, if you know anything about his work at all, he's a poet and a writer of water and the land. He was born in Michigan. He's been a visiting writer at the University of Montana and at Interlochen Center for the Arts. And he's also a fly fishing guide. You can feel in his poems the closeness to the senses of a fly fisherman, and at the same time, the way the poems fly off, pardon the pun, into the visionary, into the imagination. This third book of poems, which just came out this year from Wayne State University Press, as I said, is called Ragged Anthem. Okay, here's an example. This is a poem called Boy with Tree Frog. He caught the singer in his hands before it sang, slick, jumping like a pulse thing in the small cave his palms made, pliable, bird-boned, blinking other, before it could join the bark-hugging horde that issued call by call, day's dirge, issued evening, dusk, a focalized riot of geese calls, then dark, and the susurrus of cupped wingtips cutting water, a moon above detangling itself from pines, its light like spilled scales across the lake, like the liquid incarnation of a god whose first command is release. And so he did, the little live thing, back into a world that begs to be breathed, not remembered. You know he's been there. He's held that frog. He's heard those geese. The poem just breathes immediate life. And look how it stretches beyond with its metaphors, the moon detangling itself from the pines, its light like spilled scales across the lake, and so on. Not to say there aren't people in this book, and humor and great human tenderness. The son, the daughter, a teacher, a waitress, some appear more than once. Here's a poem that gives us the earth through the mouth of a young daughter and of a dying father. You know the word swale, a low place, kind of a marshy place between ridges. Swale. If it isn't the prettiest word in the language, tell me what is. The S, a blue racer's disappearance, making secret the place, the lips squinched, poised at the W, then parting the way in before the tongue lands lightly on grass, wet as it was when I was a child. When I spoke as a child, if mostly to myself, surrounded by stems bent by their seeds, a poised wave cresting green and shade it cast, cooling the trough of what I called a ditch. My father taught me the proper word, a hint of which I hear as my daughter insists she's a big gale and should be allowed to travel to the hospice bed with me. My father, whose mouth will open a few more times to say he's not hungry, a wind indeed. What a strong gust you are, I say, but her face reddens. No, she stomps, big gale, the young tongue's way, I see, of saying girl. It's hard to pin this book down, actually, and that is its strength. Just when you think it's this kind of tenderness, here comes a grittier kind in a poem called Poem in Which Morgan Freeman Narrates the Apocalypse. As many ways to get to heaven as to the pharmacy. Aborted baby, suicide bomb, the leper's feet when washed appeared skinless. Soiled grandmother needs her bedclothes changed again. On the schoolyard, a boy bounces a half-flat basketball, the worn rubber rising almost to his hand. Tending this pulse, he is one of the seven beings holding Earth in orbit, or he is tardy for class. Likewise, a syringe shining beneath the hoop, left by a man who's very high if he isn't scrambling to prep an IV for his wife who declined to wear her blonde wig today. Pockets emptied, he stands stymied as the ball, lofted toward the hoop, rattles chain-link net, but swish or air ball, it's hard to tell from here. This boy is a far cry from the one with the tree frog, yet they are both held so gently. They are intensely felt. Sometimes, as in this poem, the intensity comes from the felt distance from what the world can offer and what's actually here. Dombrowski's always alert to the young mind, the way it's alive to the moment. Here's one about a teacher whose sympathy with her students' lust wins out over duty. It's long and skinny, two beats per line, and it's called The Congressman's Daughter. You should remember the title. That's frequently true of Chris's poems. You kind of need to hang on to the title. The Congressman's Daughter. That no one taught us what specifics of tree our number two pencils were made from could be precisely the reason we're warping to Hades in a Hermes clutch, but we'll pardon her as she had tests for standardized to teach to. Ms. Dolan, a bulldog until the bubble forms were filled, a graphite mass of pupils caught me flushed one recess in the janitor's closet with June McKee, fairest daughter of our house's most distinguished member. He rumored to drink Irishly and return from interns' offices with shirt tails untucked. The desks back then had basins, doors that hinged like coffin lids. The books in this cumbersome metaphor, a vehicle for what tenor? Her pupils constricting at the fluorescent light as the kids from Foursquare filed in, but Dolan never called our folks, casting her vote for desire over order. You can be so many things in this world, but you can only be so many things in this world. I dig these snap shirts, their pearl buttons clicking against the keys. How did Nembrowski know to end with the shirt buttons? I think he was looking to bring us back from his abstract musing about what you can be to what he actually is, a guy wearing a shirt with snap buttons. I want to end with the lyrical first section of a poem called Going Home. It's much longer, and I'll say something about that in a minute. There must be rivers there, if there's a there to which we depart, or, as some say, return. Rivers strewn with moonlight and discarded shopping carts, mouths of springs choked with forget-me-nots, long slavering rills threading rusted culvert grates, rivulets splitting thickets, and boulder-curled cataracts pocked by sewers pissing virulent strains of time. I've imagined them, all the world's rivers moving at once. I think we'll need them, and forever. And just so you don't think he's floating along on beauty and reverie, the next section begins with a decapitated body floating in a river, and after that, the head. This is typical of the surprise movement of poems by Chris Dombrowski. The book is Ragged Anthem from Wayne State University Press.
Thank you, Fleta. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. My thanks to Jeff Smith, Natalie Ruth Joynton, and Fleta Brown. Also, kudos to Daniel Wanshura for his skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, this is Aaron Stander wishing you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.